The DOJ had a wild weekend with the Southern District of New York office.
What we can say for sure is that that office has had its eye on this administration, notwithstanding the fact that it's a part of this administration.
Heads roll, but the result might not be what the Trump administration wanted out of a chaotic 72 hours. I'm Tanzina Vega, and it's The Takeaway for Monday, June 22nd. Also on the show, the NFL's abrupt change of heart on player protests for racial injustice.
It was an astounding moment that the head of our number one sport in America kind of come out and be so unambivalent in saying that, hey, we should be backing social justice movements, and we were wrong in the past.
But first, DACA survived a Supreme Court test last week, but the program is still on dangerous ground. That's where we start today.
I believe the Supreme Court decision today is a true indictment of the way President Donald Trump does his business. We have tried to say that over and over to America in our 84 lawsuits against this administration, that the way Donald Trump does business is not America's way, that the way Donald Trump does business is not according to the rule of law.
California Attorney General Javier Becerra there at a virtual conference on Thursday. Thursday was the same day that the Supreme Court ruled against the Trump administration's attempt to end Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, also known as DACA. DACA was established by the Obama administration in 2012, and it was meant as a way to protect hundreds of thousands of immigrants who were brought to the U.S. as children from being deported. President Trump tried to end the program in September 2017, but the move was blocked in the lower courts. With the Supreme Court's ruling last week, DACA is safe for now. For more on this, we turn to Nicole Narea, an immigration reporter at Vox. Nicole, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Tanzina.
Also with us is Shobha Sivaprasad Wadia, director of the Center for Immigrants' Rights Clinic at Penn State Law and author of Banned: Immigration Enforcement in the Time of Trump. Shobha, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
So, Nicole, let's start with you. What does the Supreme Court decision mean for DACA recipients? Many of these folks have been here since they were children and have now they're studying, they're working. Does that say that they can continue to live their lives?
So Dreamers are feeling like they can breathe a little easier for the moment. This is a hard-won victory after years of litigation since Trump tried to end the DACA program in 2017. So last week, at least, they were celebrating. For many of them, DACA represents their life and livelihood in the U.S. They've been, as you said, settled here for years and established families and careers here. So the prospect of being deported, as the Trump administration had said it would do if they lost their DACA status, would have been very devastating to them. But as you said, this ruling really only represents momentary relief, and they still face challenges ahead because Trump could still well end DACA.
And Shobha, let's talk a little bit about some of the judges' responses here in the opinion. Chief Justice John Roberts wrote the majority opinion. Does it leave the door open for another attempt at dismantling DACA?
Well, that depends. The court did offer a victory for the rule of law and for Dreamers last Thursday and answered two questions. First, can the case be reviewed by the court? They answered yes. And second, whether the way the Trump administration ended DACA was lawful. And to that, the court said no and found that the way that DACA ended was arbitrary and capricious under administrative law. So what could happen next when it comes to the administration? They could follow the rules of what the lower courts do on remand and reinstate DACA as it existed in 2012. That's what the face of the decision offers. On the other hand, the Department of Homeland Security could decide to write a new memorandum and provide more explanation or elaboration that the Roberts Court found to be lacking. And if that happens, maybe there's a possibility for DACA to end at some point in the future.
And Shoba, just quickly, we also know that Sonia Sotomayor, Justice Sotomayor, wrote her own separate opinion criticizing the court for not taking into account Trump's past racist and anti-immigrant remarks. Your thoughts on that opinion?
Correct. So she did join the decision on administrative law, but also wanted to carve out her own position on the equal protection claim. And I think these were important words. She found that the words of the president, the way he talked about Mexicans, for example, helped to, quote, create a strong perception that the decision to end DACA was based on discriminatory animus. So she would have allowed the equal protection claim to move forward. And I think it's interesting because you see that she shared a similar sentiment when she issued her dissent in the travel ban case and found that animus was driving the various versions of the travel ban that excludes people from majority Muslim countries. I think it's also an interesting way to think about where we are as a country now. Right now, Justice Sotomayor was on her own. But if we look at the court of public opinion, the conversation about race and racism in America is surfacing in significant ways. So maybe next time when this claim comes around again, Justice Sotomayor will not be alone.
Nicole, do we know, stepping away from DACA specifically for the moment and looking more at sort of at the broader landscape here in terms of deportations, specifically, we know that there are still folks, you know, the news media may have pivoted to covering other topics, but there are still families at the border. There are still people living in these detention centers. So I'm just wondering, Nicole, can you give us a sense of whether this moment has affected other deportations or the potential for deportations around the country?
Well, not necessarily this moment in particular in terms of DACA, but I do think that this has been a loss for the Trump administration, and immigration has long been one of his signature issues. And going into an election year, he really is hearkening back to the anti-immigrant agenda that seemed to resonate with his base in 2016. And he's doing that by enacting new restrictions on asylum as well as on legal immigration. On asylum, he's been really trying to dismantle the asylum system for years now, and it was already incredibly difficult for people arriving at the southern border to obtain asylum, but the pandemic has given him the opportunity to implement even more stringent restrictions. For example, he's invoked a provision of immigration law that allows officials to turn away anyone who could pose a risk of spreading contagious disease, and implemented a new program that rapidly returns asylum seekers back to Mexico without even a medical inspection. Already over 20,000 people have been expelled through that program, including unaccompanied children. He also recently proposed a rule that would methodically gut the asylum system in a way that would block most people from obtaining asylum even beyond the pandemic. It would vastly expand immigration officials' authority to reject asylum seekers' applications without so much as a hearing, as well as make it all but impossible for victims of gang-related and gender-based violence to obtain protection in the U.S. So on the whole, Trump has really been clamping down on the asylum system as well as on legal immigration. In April, he issued an executive order that temporarily suspended the issuance of new green cards, and we approve over 350,000 green card applications per year. So if Trump decides to keep this ban in place through the end of the year, it could really impact hundreds of thousands of people. He's also planning to issue an executive order restricting foreign workers coming on visas on the premise of protecting American workers, though there's some debate over whether foreign workers actually do displace American workers, and that could affect over 230,000 people. And he said over the weekend that he would announce it by today, so we could well see those restrictions coming down very soon.
Shoba, Nicole, thank you for that, because I think it's important for us to remember the moment that we're living in that has now, just in the past couple of months, really become, shall we say, intense in the United States. We're dealing with the coronavirus pandemic. We're dealing with now the third or almost more than 3 weeks of continual protests across the country for racial justice. Shoba, can you tell us what the role of immigrants has been in uprisings against police brutality that we're seeing right now? And is there any overlap that we're witnessing in terms of the fight for example, abolishing ICE and defunding the police?
Yeah, those are all great questions. And the history of immigration enforcement in this country bears a lot of resemblance to what our criminal justice system looks like. In connecting some of the dots in this moment, even at these very protests, where the American public is saying no more to the deaths of unarmed Black men and women, you have the administration making the choice to deploy ICE and CBP officers to protests to conduct arrests. So I find that troubling on a few levels, including but not limited.
Shoba, I just want to clarify there. You said to conduct arrests, to arrest whom? You're saying that there are ICE officials that are being deployed to protests for racial justice and are seeking out what they believe would be undocumented folks?
Well, that's certainly one target. And what is troubling about that is that ICE's own policy says that it will not conduct immigration enforcement in locations such as rallies and protests. Another overlap is with regard to immigration detention, which is one of the largest forms of mass incarceration in this country and is one that houses largely Brown and Black immigrants. So I think there's overlap when we think about detention and who we detain and who we deport and this movement.
Nicole, we got about a minute left. Curious about how you think this is going to play out for 2020 in terms of the president's reelection campaign. We saw an anemic showing over the weekend at his rally in Tulsa. Then, you know, this comes after a week where the Supreme Court ruled against the president twice, including on one of his key issues, which is immigration. How is this going to play out in the campaign trail? A minute left.
He really seems to be sort of grasping at straws here in terms of making immigration one of his core issues and alienating members even of his own party in terms of enacting restrictions on immigration and also in really clamping down on Black and Brown communities throughout this whole movement for racial justice. And it seems that, at least based on recent polling, that Joe Biden has pulled ahead in recent weeks. But, you know, it's really not clear what will happen in November. And I think that could really have an impact for DACA recipients who right now are still in a state of limbo.
Nicole Nerea is an immigration reporter at Vox, and Shoba Sivaprasad Wadia is a professor at Penn State Law and the director of the Center for Immigrants' Rights Clinic. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
The Southern District of New York has a new acting U.S. attorney, at least for now. Audrey Strauss, the current deputy U.S. attorney for the SDNY, will temporarily replace Jeffrey Berman in the role. The move is just the latest in a string of actions that appear to serve President Trump's interests over those of the DOJ. Berman was a Trump appointee, but his office had led several investigations into allies of the president, including an ongoing investigation involving Rudy Giuliani. On Friday night, Attorney General Bill Barr announced that Jeffrey Berman, the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, would be stepping down. Initially, Berman refused to go quietly in saying he would stay in his position until the Senate confirmed a replacement. But Barr then applied more pressure, writing Berman a second letter emphasizing that it was in fact the president who was firing him. Speaking with reporters on Saturday, the president disputed his involvement.
We have a very capable attorney general, so that's really up to him. I'm not involved.
Joining me now is Aruna Vishnawatha, a reporter covering the Justice Department for The Wall Street Journal. Aruna, thanks for being with us.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Stuart Gerson, former acting attorney general of the United States for the first 4 months of the Clinton administration and assistant attorney general before that. Welcome to The Takeaway, Stuart.
Thanks.
So, Stuart, you spent decades working within the federal government, both for U.S. attorneys and within the Justice Department. What was your reaction to Berman's firing over the weekend?
Well, it was a great surprise, of course, because the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York has been vigorous in attacking questions of fraud and corruption over the years. No one has ever heard a complaint externally that Berman was asleep at the switch. Indeed, he was praised by the Attorney General, who claims even to have offered him another job at a higher level, which also raises questions. But the fact is that that office was well known. It brought the case against Michael Cohen. It is investigating Rudy Giuliani. It has charged two of his associates, and we know, at least on a hearsay basis, but a reliable hearsay basis, that office has been and continues to investigate financial arrangements related to this administration that are of a questionable nature.
And of those financial arrangements, you're referring to President Trump's connection to Deutsche Bank or beyond?
Well, I'm certainly referring to the connection with Deutsche Bank. And in that that office also is working on referrals from the Mueller team and the Mueller investigation. It also could involve other matters, including Russia, the Ukraine, and the like of that. But what we can say for sure is that office has had its eye on this administration, notwithstanding the fact that it's a part of this administration. That's part of the tradition of that U.S. Attorney's Office, of the U.S. Attorney's Office in Washington, which prosecuted Nixon associates during the Nixon administration. These offices both are famed for their independence and for their energy, and it made it all the more surprising that Berman was removed.
Aruna, we saw, as we mentioned at the top, a little bit of chaos coming out of the Justice Department over the weekend with very public back and forth between Berman and Barr. I'm assuming that's not reflective of the traditional process for replacing a U.S. attorney.
Right, it's not. And even just to step back a little bit, the appointment of a new U.S. attorney when there's only 6 months in a presidential term is very unusual in and of itself, because you're then trying to ask the Senate to sort of burn time to confirm a new nominee who may only be on the job for a few months. And it's unlikely anyone really wants to go through that process to potentially only have it for a few months. So it's all a very unusual time to be doing this. And then to do it through a press release on a Friday night without having even clarified with that individual that, yes, you are going to be stepping down, and then sort of having the chaos of the next 18 hours play out is very unusual.
Stuart, to Aruna's point in terms of how this actually went down, if you will, is that an indication that the president could be really concerned about what Berman's findings were going to be before he leaves office?
It's hard to read a mind like that, especially a mind that's so disordered. But look at the circumstantial evidence. It comes on the heels by a day of the Bolton revelations dominating the front page. It follows the termination of five inspectors general, including the prospective inspector general who's going to oversee the CARES Act funding, some of which seems to have gone in excessive measure to people who were aligned with the president. There are a lot of issues of corruption here, and it was reported yesterday in a number of outlets that the president had been concerned about the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District, starting with the Cohen prosecution. So, I mean, that's the evidence that we have, and it suggests an interesting thing. I and others in my checks and balances group and the Lincoln Project have all been focusing on the affronts to the rule of law and authoritarianism. And it would seem that if indeed the president was involved in this, Berman's discharge wouldn't have been enforced without the president. So we take it at that. But it looks as if the president is at the helm with respect to these affronts to the rule of law. And then the attorney general, Bill Barr, is just acting as his button man. He's carrying it out.
I do want to sort of step back and look at Bill Barr's tenure so far. Can you give us some examples of other times that Barr has come under fire?
Sure. And I will also just add that our understanding is that the Attorney General and U.S. Attorney Berman had sort of clashed going back from the beginning of Barr's tenure as Attorney General. And he had tried to replace him a year ago. And then there were cases that came out that sort of made it politically untenable. And so this has been something that the Attorney General has been trying to do for a while. We don't think that it explicitly was precipitated by anything in a specific investigation right now that prompted it, just to add that. But he has come under fire from a lot of critics for various decisions that he's made that seem to be more in line with the president's interests rather than the Justice Department's interests.
Aruna, on Friday, Attorney General Barr said the president will be nominating Jay Clayton, who's the current chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, to ultimately replace Berman. Any idea why Clayton?
You know, the administration thinks pretty highly of Mr. Clayton. He expressed interest in this job at the U.S. Attorney in Manhattan, and they decided to give it to him. It's an unusual choice in the sense that most people picked for that job have previously been prosecutors, not only been prosecutors, but also prosecutors in that office, and he was neither.
And, you know, we mentioned, again, we have to remind our listeners that Berman was a Trump appointee. He was appointed by then-Attorney General Jeff Sessions. So I'm wondering, what are congressional Democrats saying about his ouster?
A lot of congressional Democrats have sort of criticized the move over the weekend, and you have even Lindsey Graham, the chair, Republican chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, whose committee would have to first vote on this nomination, coming out and saying he had not been consulted. He would defer to the Senate tradition of giving the home state senators essentially sort of veto power over who the nominee is. And you have both New York senators coming out and basically calling on Mr. Clayton to withdraw his nomination. And so it seems unlikely that he is going to actually end up getting confirmed, you know, this year. If Trump does get reelected, then perhaps he would have a better chance at that point.
Stuart, I'm wondering whether or not, you know, because we're sort of talking about the system here. Does the system for appointing and dismissing U.S. attorneys, can it be reworked? Does it need reworking? Does this moment call for a reexamination of how this is done?
No, it really doesn't. The Vacancy Act works quite well, and you can see it working well in the sense that the administration has shot itself in the foot with regard to this.
And explain to our listeners and to me what the Vacancy Act is, because I'm not versed in that.
The Vacancy Act deals with exactly this kind of question. What happens when there is a vacancy of a constitutional officer, that is one who has been confirmed by the Senate? And here, where there is a vacancy created by the action of the administration, who is it that serves in the interim? It is generally another constitutional officer or the first assistant. And that's where the administration is not getting its own way. I mean, what it had wanted to do, move Berman out, replace him on an interim basis with the U.S. attorney from New Jersey, who has had no other connection with the Southern District of New York, and then proceed with the permanent replacement of Mr. Clayton. That's not what's happening. That's been untracked by a variety of things, including the disarray that we've been reading about and the protests from various quarters. And so what has ended up is if there was a question on Attorney General Barr's mind or the president's mind that the Southern District was acting too independently, now they get the first assistant United States attorney serving on an interim basis. And she is a professional. She's been involved in the affairs of that office for a long time. She's a tough prosecutor. She's taken on very worthy adversaries and defeated them in court. And there's very little question that she's not going to do a fine job and be at least as independent-minded as the person she succeeded.
Stuart Gerson is a former assistant attorney general who served under President George H.W. Bush. And Aruna Viswanatha is a reporter covering the Justice Department for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Each election season, political memoirs abound, doorstops that sometimes divulge more than intended.
No matter how diligently they present themselves in the most electable light, they always reveal themselves, their insecurities, their fears, their ambitions.
How to read a Politico on this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
In 2016, San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick knelt on one knee during the national anthem to protest racial inequality and injustice. After that, the NFL had been very vocal about the league's opposition to on-field player protests. This month, amid ongoing uprisings across the United States against police brutality towards Black people, the league has reversed that stance.
We, the National Football League, condemn racism and the systematic oppression of Black people. We, the National Football League, admit we were wrong for not listening to NFL players earlier and encourage all to speak out and peacefully protest. We, the National Football League, believe Black Lives Matter.
That was NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell issuing a public apology on June 6th. Last week, Goodell told ESPN that he would welcome and encourage teams to sign Kaepernick, who'd been shut out of the league since 2017. Meanwhile, other sports leagues, including the MLB, NBA, the WNBA, and even NASCAR, have all shown varying levels of support for the Black Lives Matter movement and for improving racial equity. But whether the leagues are actually planning to back up those words with action is another matter. To talk more about how the sports world is addressing racism and player activism, I was joined by Michael Fletcher, a senior writer for ESPN's Enterprise team.
It was an astounding moment to, you know, sort of have the head of this kind of our number one sport in America kind of come out and sort of be so unambivalent in saying that, hey, we should be backing social justice movements and we were wrong in the past. So it was just a wow moment.
Roger Goodell did not mention Colin Kaepernick by name, which is kind of astounding given that Kaepernick is the reason why we're even having this conversation right now. Michael Bennett called Roger Goodell's Black Lives Matter message, quote, "It was almost like a slap in the face." How are other folks responding to Goodell and the NFL right now, given this sort of omission of Kaepernick?
Well, you know, there's a mix. You know, I think there are some people who look at it as a genuine gesture, at least. And not only did, you know, Goodell make this announcement, but he also pledged, I believe, $250 million over 10 years to sort of add to the NFL's kind of social justice initiatives. You know, they fund some community groups and things like that in conjunction with something called the Players Coalition. So some people they're heartened by that. But at the same time, many people are like Michael Bennett. They think it's, if not a slap in the face, it's just another sign of rank hypocrisy. And even Malcolm Jenkins, who in some a player now for the New Orleans Saints, who was a leader of the Players Coalition who many people in Kaepernick's camp saw as maybe undermining Kaepernick's interests by accepting the NFL's money to begin with. He even came out and said that, you know, Kaepernick should be given a job in the NFL, and this really is not complete unless that happens.
The last time you and I spoke, Michael, it was regarding the NFL partnership with Jay-Z, and I'm wondering, whatever happened to that? Did they actually make any change for the Black community with that partnership?
It's unclear. The only thing we know that Roc Nation did with the NFL was sponsor the last Super Bowl halftime show, kind of bring the talent together for that. There was some sort of fan gear, branded gear, social justice branded gear that was sold in conjunction with this effort, and the proceeds of which would go to community groups. But beyond that, it's hard to know. I mean, sort of the harshest interpretation, and I'm not saying I endorse this, but I've heard people say it, is that, you know, essentially the league used Jay-Z's presence as cover.
In having this conversation, I'm not only thinking about Colin Kaepernick, but I'm also thinking about Laura Ingraham's remark to LeBron James for protesting years ago, where she said he should just
shut up and dribble.
Athletes are doing a lot more than shutting up and dribbling right now, Michael. What is the NBA or the WNBA, how have they been protesting?
As you look around the world, what's become kind of the international gesture in this moment is to take a knee. And you've seen it with the NBA players as well and WNBA players. Most notable, I think, is LeBron James, arguably the biggest star in all of sports in America, who launched a campaign for voting rights and to get people to the polls and trying to move beyond that realm of protest and move into action that will really bring actionable change. And the WNBA players have been the same. WNBA is probably the most socially conscious league, I think, out of all the professional leagues that I know of. I mean, those women are plugged in, they're smart, and they're active. So it feels like Laura Ingram's on the wrong side of history here. Like, far from shutting up and dribbling, athletes are taking action.
Laura Ingram, not to make this segment about her, but she did defend Drew Brees.
Well, you know, well, Drew Brees, as we know, and, you know, I'll say this about Drew Brees, just to I'll defend him for a second. Drew Brees is one of the most generous philanthropists in the NFL. His foundation has given away millions and millions of dollars to help causes in New Orleans and beyond. So Drew Brees has been a good person, but Drew Brees, for a moment, sort of went off the rails and described Kaepernick's protest as a disrespecting the flag, which of course played into the narrative that President Trump has tried to put out there, and many people who oppose Kaepernick tried to put out there. And everyone knows that that's far from what Kaepernick had in mind. But Brees himself withdrew that statement. And even after he withdrew it, President Trump tried to put pressure on him, and Drew Brees would not yield. He said, you know, it was a mistake. And I don't think it's just a PR thing. I mean, I don't know Drew Brees personally, but, you know, I know people who know him, and they say that that's a good dude. And, you know, he misspoke, or, you know, he said maybe what he meant, but he didn't realize kind of how it would be taken, maybe. But he certainly withdrawn that position.
NASCAR recently announced that they were banning Confederate flags in terms of their symbolism. Confederate flags feel like a little old, Michael, to be banning right now, but apparently they were part of what NASCAR does. What does that signify? There is only, from what I understand, there's one black NASCAR driver who is driving around with Black Lives Matter on his car.
That's right. Bubba Wallace. And the Confederate flag, for worse, I was going to say for better or worse, but just for worse, has been a symbol that some people have often taken with them to NASCAR races. And it was in that context, people would argue, people who would salute that flag would say it was just a, you know, a sign of heritage and things like that. It's not a racially hateful symbol, which, of course, I think is preposterous. But nonetheless, that's what they'd say. But they banned that. Not only that, the head of NASCAR made a statement in favor of a Black Lives Matter. And many NASCAR drivers have backed that up. I think it just speaks to kind of the astounding moment that we find ourselves in this country. It's really striking. And what we've seen it, not just in sports, but obviously in corporate America, everyone is uttering the words now, Black Lives Matter. Now, obviously, it remains to be seen what people mean by that. But certainly, we're in a moment now that I don't think any of us would have predicted even 6 months ago.
Michael Fletcher, senior writer for ESPN's Enterprise team. Always a pleasure to have you on. Thanks for joining us.
All right. Thank you.
And we have an unfortunate update to talk about regarding Bubba Wallace. Today, NASCAR announced that a member of Wallace's team found a noose hanging in their garage stall at the Talladega Speedway. The team member then reported the incident to NASCAR. In a statement, the racing organization said, quote, "We are angry and outraged and cannot state strongly enough how seriously we take this heinous act." For a lot of people who are in therapy, dealing with family issues is one of the biggest topics of discussion. As we continue to see the uprising for racial justice, we wanted to have a conversation about the unique challenges facing Black parents. So to round out the show, we delve into the personal story of one man.
I'm Abdul Ali. I'm a writer living in Baltimore, and I'm a fellow with the Robert W. Deutsch Foundation this year.
Growing up, Abdul had a very complicated relationship with his father.
He was absent off and on. Certainly he had his own demons that he had to fight.
And as a result, that led to a lifetime of complicated emotions towards his father. But now Abdul himself is a father, and he said he realized he needed to grapple with his feelings towards his dad to nurture his own relationship with his daughter. And for Abdul, therapy was key. And he recently wrote about it for the Boston Globe.
But ultimately, I think what I wanted to do, and this was something new for me, was to try to frame him in a complicated light, not just in a negative light, but in a complicated light, which meant that I had to see some of those joyful moments that we shared together. And that's what I tried to capture in the piece.
Abdul and I spoke about his journey and understanding the anger he felt towards exploring his own personal growth to ditch harmful stereotypes.
I think that at 36, I saw that, you know, if I didn't make a shift, I would become a cliche. I would become an angry Black man. And I did not want that to happen. And so I've been doing a lot of work, you know, lots of hours in therapy, and kind of reimagining how I want to be in the world, not just for myself, but also for my daughter, because it's all connected.
You said you didn't want to be an angry Black man. And I often think about how anger is something that Black people and more broadly people of color are often not allowed to experience. So what do you mean when you say you didn't want to be that?
So I didn't find it particularly useful. Certainly, I mean, how long can you hold a grudge, right? And so it's almost like playing this game of holding your breath underwater. Eventually, someone's going to drown. So I wanted to speak truth to power. I wanted to put myself on notice, put my father on notice, and just, you know, put some different energy out there. I knew firsthand that many folks in my age group were going through the same thing. And it's like, we got to heal ourselves, right? First, you know, we may never get to change the older generation, but we heal ourselves first and create some new traditions and trajectories in our families.
Abdul, one of the things that I find difficult writing from the perspective of a Puerto Rican slash, you know, New York person here, a Latina, is wanting to be truthful and also not wanting to, quote unquote, air our dirty laundry, right, to largely white audiences that sure. could potentially continue to say, oh, look, you know, you're falling into those stereotypes. How were you able to work through some of the sort of concerns that I think a lot of Black and brown people have when it comes to talking about the difficulties and the nuances in our upbringings?
Had I stayed on a superficial level and just talked about all the things I was angry about, I think I would have been in a stereotypical space. But I would like to think that I broke the ice and went deeper than just a superficial level. And I got to see, you know, my father as human. And as human, we are fallible and we're vulnerable and we're fragile. And sometimes we're victims to the times, you know, that we were born into and the circumstances that we're born into. But also, we can be victorious and triumphant as well. And I think, I don't know, I think I'm a better person, you know, having gotten to know who he is. And, you know, he's not a passive person, you know, he's a fighter. And I would like to think that I get some of that from him.
Another part of what you mentioned earlier and sort of how you found some healing in the relationship with your father, at least from your perspective, has been therapy. Something that communities of color, Black and brown communities, are now, I think, beginning to show some more acceptance to, but I think there's still some cultural barriers in the way there. How did you find therapy worked for you? Like, well, were you able to really feel vulnerable enough to work through some of these issues with your therapist?
With the right therapist, yes. You know, you find someone that you feel comfortable with. You know, in my case, finding therapists of color, you know, where you don't have to explain a whole lot of things and you don't have to worry about the white gaze or, you know, or anything like that. I think that that is very helpful. And there are resources out there, you know, to help locate, you know, therapists of color. And I was grateful to do that. But for me, I think it was probably a show of strength to be able to say, I'm not okay. I've been carrying this, you know, and I don't even know what it's like to walk straight, because I've been carrying this load for decades. And to be able to be in a space where you can put it down and then open it up and see, is this your stuff you're carrying or is this someone else's stuff? And it's great to be able to have that perspective. And I think that's strength. I mean, I think that it's important for us to prioritize our happiness, our well-being, and to not normalize pain. Because I think that that's kind of a message, I think, that we get growing up, that this is just the way it is. But I think when you push back on that and say, well, maybe there's another way, I think that's where therapy and other things, you know, can sort of present alternate routes, you know, to having the life that you want. I know this sounds very zenny, and I don't mean to sound that way, but I just think that just taking things as it is or as it always has been, you know, I don't know if that's working well for us. So I think that it's time for us to shift gears and try something else, you know, for our health.
In therapy, the question often comes up, I think, about whether we're looking to accept things that have happened or looking to forgive the people who we feel have hurt us and or wronged us in some way. Abdul, when you are in therapy or have been in therapy as a Black man confronting the issues that you say have affected you for years with your father, are you at the point of acceptance? Are you at the point of forgiveness? Or is that even, was that even a goal for you?
I think the initial goal was to hand over this heavy load, you know, I don't know, bury it, burn it, something. I think I'm at the place where I'm sort of working on the forgiving. You know, as a writer, memory is so important. So the forgetting, I think, is probably the thing that we can't do. But certainly, I think humanizing my father, not wanting to vilify him, and to look at his life in a larger context of what was happening in our country and the inner cities. You know, I think that that has really been an interesting journey, because that's something I didn't have the capacity to do when I was younger. It was easy to kind of rely on these tropes, you know, these stereotypes that we hear of. So I think, you know, it's a journey. I'm grateful for the journey. And I also accept that things may never be what I want them to be, because you can't make up that time. So that part is a little sad. But I mean, what an interesting relationship he and my daughter have. And that's quite interesting to watch.
Abdul Ali is a Baltimore-based writer and a fellow with the Robert W. Deutsch Foundation. Abdul, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So we wanted to hear from you about this. Has therapy shaped your relationship with your parents?
This is Laura Williams, and I live in Andover, Massachusetts. Therapy has been tremendously helpful for me in healing from my relationship with my mother. My mom was a single parent and also schizophrenic. We had a really complex relationship, and very early on in my childhood, I was the one taking care of her. My mom was very abusive, and I learned over time to make peace with having a whole rainbow of all of my emotions about her. Certainly loved her, but I also felt anger, sadness, loss, and compassion. And I realized through therapy that it's all allowed. My mom died in 2006, and I'm so glad that I was able to find some peace with her and within myself before she died.
Hi, this is Elizabeth Jarvis calling from Oakland, California. My mother had undiagnosed bipolar disorder and borderline personality disorder when I was a child. My father worked long hours, and my mom could be very cruel. My brothers became heroin addicts. I didn't want to do the same thing, so I got into therapy when I was about 16 years old. So therapy has been a mainstay in my life and has really helped me. I learned early to accept my mom's cruelty and to have compassion for her. Obviously, someone got to her when she was very young, and it changed who she was.
Hi, my name is Stephanie. I live in Minneapolis. I was lucky enough to find a therapist right as the pandemic was starting to process my relationship with my self-destructive father. He lost his job 8 years ago and has never bounced back. He's essentially homeless right now, and there's nothing that anyone in our family can do to help him. My brother and I have both tried helping him over the years, and he's never been able to help himself or admit that he has his own mental health problems to work through, so it's been really difficult to help him when he can't acknowledge that there's a problem. And my therapist has been able to help me name these emotions so that I can process what my own emotional needs are. Being able to name my feelings brings a lot of clarity to my life, and I really believe that therapists are essential workers.
This is Nan Baker. I live in Dallas, Texas. And yes, therapy has helped me heal relationships with my parents. I have learned to say the unsayable, tell the hidden, and find compassion for both my parents and myself.
Hi, this is Katrina from Maplewood. I have used therapy for relationships of all sorts, but not for the relationship with my parents. And I probably should, because so much of what we learn through our lives is about how we were raised as children. And I was raised in a separate home with parents who were divorced and all kinds of issues. But I'm okay now, so I haven't thought I needed therapy.
This is Lynn calling from Chanhassen. Yes, I participated in years and years of therapy. My parents divorced when I was 13. My mother moved away, and my father's new wife moved into the home that I grew up in. It was a very difficult time for me. I was angry for many years until I took the time to go through extensive therapy as an adult and to understand that my parents are human and had emotional needs of their own.
Another Monday in the books, folks. Thanks for being along with us for the ride. We've got a big week ahead of us with a lot of good conversations. We'll be back with you tomorrow. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway.